Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, your week in IndyCar listener Q&A show brought to us by some dear friends. So why don't we say thank you to them, do a really short intro, and get rocking with as many of your questions as possible, knowing that on a very short turnaround with two consecutive IndyCar race weekends in a row. Time to say a big thank you to our show partners on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, starting with FAF Technologies, build-to-print composites manufacturing company. They're specializing in medium to large-scale automotive, motorsports, and military applications. Visit FAFTechnologies.com. It's P-F-A-F-F Technologies.com to learn more about their services and how they can benefit your business. Next, it's the Justice Brothers, makers of premium additives, lubricants, and cleaners, and servicing the automotive and motorsports industries for more than 85 years, with victories in all the biggest North American motor races, including the Indianapolis 500, the 24 Hours of Daytona. The Justice Brothers products are truly race-proven. Learn about their vast history and range of offerings at justicebrothers.com. If you're fond of awesome motor racing collectibles, including FAF Motorsports McLaren gear and goodies, pay a visit to torontomotorsports.com. And finally, we have a new online merchandise home for the podcast, thepruittstore.com, for all the show stickers, models, racing memorabilia I'm trying to sell and put towards our fund to buy a house is now live and rocking, thepruittstore.com. Thanks once again to our pal Jerry Siddeth, who puts together your questions each week, tries to come up with a amusing, entertaining, or something-ing order. And I do say I think Jerry does a wonderful job. As always, the show is indeed driven by your questions. And a submission from our friend Jim Kaiser says, a haiku tribute to the master. One thing you'll not hear is Scott Dixon telling us, I ran out of gas. That's right. This is the only podcast about IndyCars where you get haiku. So thank you, Jim. Much love to you. Hope to see you and your family again here at a race very soon. Why don't we go to Lewis Delgarno? And I know our guy, our Minister of Mirth, Lance Snyder, asked this, and some others did as well. Lewis says, how do I go about purchasing shares in Dixie Co., the refinery that's seemingly buried in the depths of the Ganassi number 9 entry? So I know that some of you, if not many of you, know the story. I'll repeat it very quickly here, and I'm going to try and do a written version of this as well. It's an old story, but I realize there's a lot of newer fans to IndyCar who might not know, but the how does Scott Dixon do that, and only Scott Dixon do that, the crazy, insane, extreme fuel saving that he does and uses to win races, not just last weekend at Long Beach, late last year at Gateway, and so many other places. It's all due to 2005, the first year the Indy Racing League was renamed the IndyCar Series, what we call it today. The first year the IRL, now the IndyCar Series, welcomed road and street course racing into their all-oval calendar. And that year at Chip Ganassi Racing, they were partnered with Toyota the year before, I believe, as well. And Toyota was going to be getting out of the series before too long. And at least for them, they did not have much horsepower. Not enough to be significantly competitive wherever they went. And so the one thing they figured they could do that might tip the balance back, I don't even want to say in their favor, but just from being so unbalanced, was fuel saving. What if Dixon could learn how to save fuel like no one else has ever saved while still making really fast and competitive lap times? Because they had a horsepower deficit that really was not going to be overcome. And so that's what they focused on, race by race, still primarily an oval series back then, but Dixon and the team worked through, tried a lot of things, and found ways for him to do just that, go incredibly fast and save a ton of fuel to open up fuel strategy options for them that might help them to leapfrog other cars, since by and large, they could not pass them on outright pace. It was a very specific problem, the end of a relationship with an engine supplier that in order to be competitive, this is what they thought might be a little bit of a equalizer. Didn't work all the way, but at least made things slightly better. But as a result of going through that intensive season, we have a Scott Dixon who knows how to do things nobody else does. Let's see. Brian Dywart, you're next. This is Marshall. Can we admit Scott Dixon is the IndyCar Gandalf? He gets into weird and impossible situations and just magically wins. Will Dixon continue to make fuel and win once the hybrid components go online? They generate power through braking, and Dixon's mastery of fuel is through the judicious use of less throttle, not braking. The energy recovery systems are not limited to harvesting under braking, Brian. They can be asked to harvest in all kinds of scenarios, even while accelerating. So this will be a new wrinkle for Dixon to master, but I don't foresee this taking away his superpower. Andrew Howell, you ask a question that, oh Lord, a lot of folks asked, involving people hitting each other and the non-equal distribution of penalties. Says, can you explain the no call on Herta, but Pato got a penalty for hitting Rossi the same way? I think race control made a bad decision on that one and possibly cost Newgarden the win. Dixon was looking prone to getting passed by Newgarden there late in the race. But I got to admit, when he got hit from behind by Herta in turn 11 there, it looked to me like Dixon might be able to hold on. So not disagreeing, there was certainly a much better chance for Joseph to try and get by Dixon while running second than while running fourth, which is where he ended up and got moved back to. But I'm with you. It makes no sense to me. Did Pato get penalized because there was damage done to Rossi's car? And, you know, there was a bigger infliction of pain and competitive negativity? I don't know. I can tell you, though, that the two hits looked awful similar. They were both a byproduct of a mistake. Pato certainly wasn't trying to hit and take out his teammate at the fountain there. Colton certainly wasn't trying to hit Joseph and risk doing damage to his car at his home race that he wants to try and win again, obviously. So, you know, these are both oopses. Why one was penalized, the other one wasn't, it makes no sense to me. I'm sure I can call and ask and understand why. I thought about doing that, but to be honest, I then said, no matter what I'm told, I can't find the logic in not giving Herta a penalty. Admittedly, I didn't really think a penalty was warranted for Pato, just because I'm not a big fan of lots of penalties. So in a perfect world, no penalty for Award, and then no penalty for Herta. But since they did hand out one the first time it happened, makes no sense to me why it didn't the second. Our pal Lord Fike asks something that a few folks have inquired about as well. Can you explain why tapping the side of Newgarden's gearbox triggered the anti-stall? It wasn't a side tap that triggered it. Is this issue new due to the pre-hybrid changes? And will the design need modification, or was this a one-off scenario? So, had nothing to do, I know this was mentioned on the broadcast, as the nose of Colton's car possibly hitting some of the electronics on the side of the gearbox and causing it to go wacky. That did happen, has happened in the past, just wasn't the case here. Lifted the rear of the car off the ground. Cars have the anti-stall system. That anti-stall system is constantly looking for 0 miles per hour while the motor's running, and it's engaged in gear. Driver comes in for a pit stop, puts the thing into neutral. No anti-stall trying to work in that scenario because the driver has indeed put the car in neutral while sitting there idling up in the air, having tires changed and otherwise. With what happened in turn 11, Colton got under the back of Joseph's car, lifted the rear tires off the ground. They were barely rotating, but were effectively not turning. Motors running, things engaged in gear, and anti-stall system says, oh, hey, let's kick you into a neutral here so the motor doesn't die. The anti-stall system did exactly what it should have done, except for there was no real stall that it needed to prevent. So, yeah, this was actually the system working 100% as intended. It was just a bit of a special scenario where it actually wasn't needed. Luke Entrop, how you doing, Luke? So this was great fun seeing Rossi tear through the field after the puncture. Going from last P27 to P10 was mega. Reminded me of 2018 Rossi at Sonoma. Full rich, off strategy. Alexander Rossi is the best Rossi. Where do you think he has to finish in the championship to keep his seat at McLaren? I don't think it's a position thing, Luke. I really don't. Knowing that Arrow McLaren sure does have some pretty enticing options in front of it right now. With Teo Pourchaire, who's returning this weekend. The team loved him. I mean, loved him. Callum Ilott as well, along with David Malukas. If this were a normal season, and the three intended full season drivers ran all season, and we started getting towards summer, this is where I think a solid appraisal of where Alexander stood in the championship might come in terms of him being a free agent and whether they wanted to extend him however many years into the future. Since this year has not gone that way and they have one or two new drivers, substitute drivers, who they are liking quite a bit along with David, I think we are staring at something where it's more a case of how competitive will Alexander be in the coming races against a Teo Pourchaire, a Pato, of course, and who knows after that. I think there might be a more immediate look here to close on how is he faring with some really solid young, Alexander's still young, but even younger challengers and chargers in his own team. He's been the guy delivering the best results so far this year. He's been the guy who, while Arrow McLaren has not been crazy capable of winning races, for however well they've been doing, I realize Pato finished a quality second at St. Pete, but seemingly just about everywhere, Rossi has been the one when things start to go a little bit sideways for the team, for whatever reason, he's there pushing hard, doing pretty impressive things. What this comes back to, though, is I think with Pourchaire in particular, if he shows extremely well this weekend in Barber, I think the heat and intensity both on David and Malukas's future, I would say also Rossi's future, really start to come into question. If Pourchaire looks like another Pato, similar, equal, maybe even better, again, we don't know. The guy's done one race, but they were impressed enough by him to say, woo, let's see what he does on a natural terrain road course at Barber. If there's an inkling that Teo could be pretty close to a match to Pato, which they have never had, and they do not have right now with Alexander, and we obviously haven't seen David race alongside Pato in the same team, same cars, but the worst thing that I think could happen for David is if they get the impression that Teo is another Pato, then they have questions to ask whether Alexander is somebody they would want to hold on to, if they would want to hopefully get to run David at some point in time this year, and who knows, maybe have a young lineup with Pato, Teo, and David, or maybe Ilott. So, Barber, this. I don't even know if the team has thought this all the way through. I've thought it through for him, but Teo Pourchaire's weekend in Barber, I think, is going to set a lot of things either in motion in terms of change or a lot of things in motion in terms of maintaining status quo. Where do we go next? Michael Howard says, MP, I noticed VK's car appeared to have no sponsor at Long Beach. Was this a one-off no sponsor, or is Ed in trouble? I mean, I did see the team's primary sponsor there. Instead of BitNile being the big thing, the founder, owner of BitNile has the, I forget, what is it called? Guys Care, Men Care, something similar, et cetera, et cetera. Interesting to see how the races that have gone unsold, the team has not chosen to dress whichever car with internal sponsors, right? Tony George, founder of the team, you know, co this, that, and the other of the team. He owns a number of businesses. Sonax, for example, we've seen on the side pod of a number of Ed Carpenter racing cars. He's the, I believe, exclusive North American importer for those German car care products, right? Hasn't been uncommon to see Sonax or whatever on a car and you go, oh, cool, that's a sponsor. It is. It's just kind of promoting the internal family business. Interesting to see how they've changed that approach this year for whichever events might not have sponsorships sold. Does that spell a problem? Not one that I know of in terms of they won't complete the season or otherwise, but there's a lot of really positive things happening in IndyCar. A lot of things in development with charters and so on and so forth. If you remember coming into the opening race of the year, I wrote about the formation of a informal owners group to bring their concerns and problems to Penske Entertainment. That happened because obviously those folks were highly concerned about a number of things. Almost all of the biggest, most timely concerns centered on money and budgets and income. Marketing is in there too, but money and things being too expensive, hard time finding the money to pay for things, that is a really big item. This is just the visual evidence of that. Dale Coyne Racing as well, having to go from event to event with its second car, searching for drivers, some who hopefully have some funding they can bring. Their primary car not being overly dripping in funds. We're starting to see some of these struggles manifest visually, and we can't ignore their roots. So, not tearing down the series, just saying that while there are some welcome and newer positive things starting to build, some of the ones with a little bit deeper roots like this, we can't ignore as well. So I think they'll be fine for the season, but you hate to see it, right? Stuart Aerith, how you doing, Starrett? Stuart? Why did I call you Starrett? We'll go Starrett, sure. Who from Penske was listening to your podcast, your past episodes about Zach Brown, and thought it was a good idea to add him to the marketing task force? True, I have mentioned that quite a few times on the podcast in years past, that one of the smartest things Penske Entertainment could do would be to engage Zach and or just outright hire McLaren to be a significant assistance in their marketing efforts. I guarantee you none of them listen to this because that would be silly. But yeah, great move. Enjoyed talking to Zach about this in depth last weekend. You hope that they listen. It's one thing to invite someone into something. It is very different to then receive their words and ideas and criticisms and decide to turn those into action items. It's just happening, so there's nothing to report in terms of, oh, Zach and or McLaren have done a full assessment of IndyCar's marketing and come back with a 300-point report. Again, we're not even 1% headed in that direction yet. Would say, though, that I love the effort. I love the move. Give it just a little bit of time to see if there's something that actually comes to pass in terms of, that is an idea or two or 10 that Zach brought, and we're going to listen and do those things. That's what I'm really looking forward to learning here in the coming months. James Malloy says, what does Fox bring that NBC may not, in a very basic way, saying besides a higher rights fee, what would IndyCar see in Fox Sports that NBC Sports doesn't provide or provide better, then goes on to criticize Fox Sports. Might be one of desire, and of necessity is the exact way I would put it, James, but here's a way to look at this. With NBC Sports, they have NASCAR for about half the season. They have IndyCar. They have IMSA. And what else do they have? They have other things. Look at Fox. They've got what? NASCAR? And that's being reduced next year in this new deal that NASCAR's done. So they'll have fewer races. I think they have the NHRA. I know that's not doing real great business television ratings wise, but they have more than one racing series. That is true. But they effectively, they're NASCAR. That's their motor racing property. Not much else comes to mind in terms of a front headlining top tier motor racing thing to present. NBC seemingly has plenty start of the year to the end of the year. Fox will be, with this new NASCAR deal, done. They broadcast, through, I believe I'm told, their NASCAR schedule, which starts in February at Daytona next year, will go through something like the middle of May. So it's not a lot of months before NBC takes over, and then some of the streaming stuff with Amazon Prime and this, that, and the other. So the main thing I'd say, James, to think about, and I realize that you do not care for their NASCAR coverage, there's big energy to have a series like IndyCar where they can broadcast it for the full year, full season. But in particular, when they hand off NASCAR to the other partners shortly right before, a week or two before the Indy 500, IndyCar then becomes their top-tier motor racing property. I realize that while Fox has NASCAR, IndyCar is NBC's top property, right? So from March through May, think of how long the IndyCar season runs. And in theory, I guess in practice as well, unless IndyCar alters the schedule heavily, IndyCar would be the top tier featured P1 pole position motor racing property on Fox for a longer duration of the year. That's a thing that I love. What we don't know is how much of the pre-NASCAR handover calendar would be on Big Network Fox versus Fox Sports 1, and hopefully not Fox Sports 2 because it just doesn't generate any real views. Like NBC Sports used to have with NBCSN. Now they use the USA Network for it, which turned in a terrible number for Long Beach last weekend of like 309,000 or whatever viewers, down almost 720,000 viewers from last year when it was on network. Fox Sports 1 actually does some pretty decent cable traffic. So I'm not saying if the early IndyCar pre-Indy 500 calendar was mostly on Fox Sports 1, that there'd be enormous ratings. I feel like they'd be better than what we're getting right now on USA. It's more the thought of, wow, when we get to the Indy 500 and through the rest of the year, barring who knows, you know, some sort of strange scheduling thing, I think IndyCar would be on Big Fox to pretty much finish out the rest of the year. If this is their number one thing to promote, if they're losing NASCAR races and maybe feeling a little less loved as a result, the idea of having IndyCar as the big shiny new thing to put all their energy behind, I like that idea. And the last thing here, as I've been told, is the head of Fox Sports from Indiana, loves IndyCar, even has his own kind of party trailer right off of, right on 16th Street. Or is it Georgetown? I forget. But like, he is well known for not only attending the Indy 500, but really, it's a hugely embedded part of his life and culture. Having that person saying, oh yeah, I want IndyCar, that to me speaks a lot louder than it's one of a couple of big properties we have and you almost never feel like you are the truly featured motorsports property. Where are we going next? VK Roy or Vic Roy or however I might pronounce that. So why does Chevrolet not have the same concerns about IndyCar costs as Honda? Or do they? But they just don't choose to voice them publicly. You are on to something here with the latter. Stylistically, Chevrolet does not like to talk about anything. Love them. Genuinely do. But yeah, asking them questions seemingly about anything that isn't simple or easy or kind of run-of-the-mill, it is a lot of no comments, and or it takes a week or 2 weeks or whatever to try and negotiate someone to say something about whatever, and then it's usually really watered down. So again, just telling you the truth of what it is. So yeah, stylistically, Chevy is not the one to voice concerns about anything publicly, at least to monkeys like me. If they say something, it tends to be their choice, their reason to do it for whatever purpose. It's something that they self-initiate. On very rare occasion, do we get leadership from Chevrolet in a press conference where you can openly ask anything. And if you do, your question right here, I could pose, and I feel like I could almost write the quote right now, which is, long-standing partners with IndyCar, great long relationship with Roger Penske, helped formed Ilmor Engineering, who builds Team Chevy IndyCar engines. We are here to support Penske Entertainment and IndyCar in whatever is best for the sport. And if they decide to make any changes to the engine formula or modify anything that would reduce costs or change costs, we would look forward to engaging with Penske Entertainment's leadership and being a positive solution to whatever might come next. Within that salad of words, I think you'd probably have the answer. So it's just a choice thing. It's been that way for a long time. It used to really piss me off. I just accepted it as that's who they are and how they do things a while ago. And honestly, it's reduced my frustration level once I just accepted knowing that it is what it is. Greg Denny, and I think a couple others asked as well, what happened to JR's McLaren that Tony Kanaan was driving last weekend at Long Beach? The beautiful 1974 Indy 500 winner, the McLaren M16D Offenhauser. What happened to it? Well, did a visor cam with Tony Friday morning. Didn't have a lot of clear laps. Motor started to not be super happy. Was just running a little bit rough. And had the next session Saturday morning, and the motor ran really rough. Didn't break in terms of blowing a hole out of the block or whatever else, but the excellent crew, the mechanics from McLaren Heritage, stuck a boroscope down the cylinders and showed me a photo they took where you could see that one of the cylinders looked like someone dropped some nails or whatever else inside of it, and between the valves and the piston popping up and down, oh, it got beat up really bad. So, reminding me that I need to post a little video that I shot Sunday of them yanking the motor out of the car and putting the car back together, because I needed to send that motor off to get fixed, because I plan on having it run here very soon. Doughboy! How you doing, Doughboy? We are almost at the end of the first wave of questions that Jerry has put together. He puts in a nice little middle tier, says, hey, if you get through the main ones quickly, here's some more you can do if you want. So Doughboy says, there was a recent discussion on NASCAR and what happens with unused tires after a race. So how does it work in IndyCar with Firestone? Super, super simple. All the tires go back and are dismounted from the wheels owned by the teams, and they return to Firestone. With how things work in IndyCar, each team signs, pays for a tire lease in the same way that they lease engines from Chevy and Honda. All those tires belong to Firestone, and whether those are used or even if there's a set or more that are unused, those go back to Firestone after the race. That is not only their physical property, but also their intellectual property. And they are not keen on letting such things go. Now, there is one exception. And I'll admit, I don't remember exactly how this works. But teams are allowed to hold on to a old set of tires to use as the tow tires. So, as you see the cars wheeled out from the transporters first thing Thursday or whenever they might be getting into the track, you'll see some nice shiny wheels, but you'll see some tires that are a bit discolored. Clearly, they've been around for years. That's their tow tires, and it's just as suggested. They're old, used for towing the car around. If you need to go over and fuel up the car, you need to go through tech or wherever else. They get used for that instead of putting beautiful, fresh tires on the car and rolling through paddocks wherever and possibly damaging them, running over whatever folks might drop or little parts and pieces. They use tow tires for that. So that's the only exception of what teams are allowed to keep. And again, could I be wrong about maybe rain tires? Possibly. I'm forgetting that part, but I know the actual slicks themselves, those go back. Dear friend of mine from north of the border says, why does IndyCar not give a toss about Canadian fans? Why does TSN, he puts in brackets, Canadian ESPN, not give a toss about IndyCar? No cable coverage last weekend when IMSA can show free and we get lowly Saudi F4 in Canada. Why is this so hard? So yeah, as I was told by a couple of friends in Canada last weekend, IMSA was shown readily and easily on cable. IndyCar was not. Had to have like a streaming tier, I think TSN Plus, in order to watch the IndyCar race. Yeah, I'm with you, friends. What's the measure of a team that's really good? Is it that they can win big races every now and then, but that's it? Or are the ones who win championships, who don't always win the most races, but they're so darn consistent, right? They're always there, thereabouts on the podium, and they do get those victories. Those are the ones who we remember as the all-timers, right? Gosh, so many championships. So much success. I just apply the same mindset here to a racing series. It's one thing if you put up a couple big wins each year. Hey, we announced this, we signed that, we got a big new circuit we're going to. Again, those are awesome. But is there a consistency to that? I'm not fixated on the big wins. I'm fixated on, are you hitting all the little things that create excellence, the equivalent of a championship win on an annual basis? It's just stuff like this where you go, hey, our dear friends in Canada, the only place that isn't the USA that we visit. It's not like IndyCar is the one sending the signal straight from, you know, the Penske Entertainment operations trailer to all different places in the world. They're not the ones setting policy for Canadian television. But it is stuff like this where I just go, yeah. I think about the ones who are consistently good, championship caliber. There just seems like there's sadly way too many of these little IndyCar related stories each year. I'm recording this Tuesday evening. Try and get this posted as soon as I'm done. First story, first or second question and answer in tomorrow, Wednesday morning's Racer Mailbag involves an equally large WTF head scratcher from the series that, I don't know, maybe it's a not as big of a deal as it struck me, but just another thing where you go, we're not here to beat you up, okay? I realize we need to beat you up sometimes because sometimes that's what you need to toughen yourself up and do better, but we just want to celebrate you. We love you. Like, truly, we love you. We want you to have nothing but victories. Good Lord, you make it hard. As my friend here says, why is this so hard? Same story. Been told for a long while. Well before the current folks who own it bought it. Ken Anderson, Ray of Sunshine. Says on their podcast, Hinch and Rossi didn't think records were going to fall at this year's Indy 500. They thought the cars would be faster than last year, but the weight distribution wouldn't be conducive to an oval. Made sense to me. What do you think? Says, as many of you have here, but I've trimmed them out just to save time. Says, as always, hugs and prayers to you and Chabrel. Thank you. We're also joined by our cat, Rosie. She's chilling in the window. Well, am I going to disagree with two IndyCar drivers? Probably not. What they're getting at, I would assume, I haven't listened to the show. What I assume they're getting at is real speed. If we're talking qualifying, you want a secure rear. You want the rear of the car to be really locked to the ground. Can be some slight controlled drifting, not oversteer, not putting in big ops at lock, but where the car is just a tiny bit free. But for the most part, you need the back of the car to be clamped down to give you confidence to turn in at a crazy rate of speed. And if there's understeer, you can manage it and lift off the throttle a little bit and get the front to come back down and keep turning. Or if there's a little bit oversteer, again, you can add a little bit of opposite lock. But you really do want the rear of your IndyCar at the 500 to be super solid. The weight reductions that have taken place have been at the rear and also at the front. But I think what they're would be referring to, have not listened to the show, is if you combine all of the weight reductions, which will make the car faster in terms of maximum potential speed, you would be shifting weight distribution forward, putting more weight on the nose, which, again, would then take some weight off the back of the car, potentially put that stability at the rear a little bit at risk. You could, of course, counteract that by adding more downforce at the rear, but that is not really a thing teams are trying to do in qualifying. They're trying to go to the most negative wing angle they can at the rear to remove as much downforce as possible. So, assuming that that is indeed what they said, that is the thought process behind what they're saying. And what will be really interesting here is to find out if indeed all that lines up and is accurate. Let's see. Where do we go? Jordan Darwin. We are definitely into a little bit of overtime, but MP, with Penske being the only Chevy team in the top 12 shootout last weekend, I wonder how good they would be with a Honda. He said, also in honor of your visit to All American Racers last week and 25 years since their last Long Beach Grand Prix, how good would a 1999 Eagle 997 Honda Firestone package have been? Well, I don't know, but if you put that Honda in there instead of a Toyota, and you make sure that there are Firestones on it back then instead of Goodyears, it would have been the best version of itself. I feel like Robbie Gordon might have been on Firestones, maybe. I'm sorry, my head's swimming a little bit here, but yeah, love the callbacks here, Jordan, as always. Honda kind of got their knockout blow back, or got that claimed here last weekend, but I don't think Chevy is anything other than capable of winning this weekend in Barber and very, very likely in May. I have not gone into a month of May with a preconceived notion of which engine supplier would be the dominant one in a while. This is the first time I'm going in thinking. Again, we'll see. Hopefully I'm disproved and it's totally equal, but yeah, I'm going into May thinking, those bow ties might be really tough to deal with. Let's see. Why don't we go to one or two more and try and shut off the show here in about 45 minutes or so. Eric Franklin, doing Eric, says, did Colton Herta bring back the Paul Tracy's chrome horn? Since indeed the nose of the Andretti Global cars do have a bit of chrome. Yes, he did. Yeah. More importantly, is going to three entries allowed Andretti to have a bit of a renaissance. The thing that has stood out to me the most, I wrote about it Sunday, which was Colton Herta yet again having the best start to any of his seasons ever in IndyCar. I realize that he won a race, I think second race of the year, however many years ago. But if you just look at where he finished at St. Pete, which I think was like fifth, wherever it was, fifth or sixth, next one at Thermal non-points was a couple spots better. And then last weekend, second at Long Beach, his best average finishes of his entire career are across these first three events. He's back in the groove. I can only hope that he stays there. Speaking with Rob Edwards, Andretti Global Chief Operating Officer, spoke about things like improved work ethic. And I'm not saying Colton was ever lazy, but just like, hey, the reason Scott Dixon, Alex Palou, Will Power, Joseph Newgarden, whomever, tend to be perennial championship contenders, not every couple years, but like they're more or less always there, is because they put in an insane amount of work between races. It's the same trait we hear about in just about every other sport. It is not just to show up on game day and swing or shoot or run or whatever it might be and you just magically win championships. It's, wow, ton of work in between. And so Rob said, hey, this is part of where Colton's upping his game. He's more mature as well. He's realizing that chucking the car down the inside of Dixon in the closing laps last weekend and putting himself at risk of not only taking himself out, but Dixon, but going from great second place points to, you know, no points, basically. That might be a consideration a couple years ago, who knows, but now he's seeing the bigger championship picture. So that's the one big thing that stands out. The other thing that is related is this. I realize that he hasn't had the results that he wants in there, but Marcus Ericsson, hello to all the damn respect you are due. Finished fifth last weekend, right? Wasn't the best Andretti car. That was indeed Colton, but he was right there, thereabouts. If you look at I think he finished 25th, Eric, at St. Petersburg, through no fault of his own, was running strong. I think he might have been the top Andretti car when he had problem with the engine. It wasn't the actual metal bits, the internal combustion bits, the air filter on one side. I think it got hit by debris and basically got pushed in and blocked off the air, feeding them one side of the motor. And again, that's not the way to make the motor run. So he was taken out early through zero fault of his own, but Erickson to me has been the okay. I guess the other way to say this is looking at how Chip Ganassi Racing had three super strong entries wherever they went last year with Pillow, Dixon, and Erickson. There is a huge gap now between Dixon and Pillow and everybody else. Let me see. I'm trying to remember exactly where the top, the third driver in the team, where they're placed currently. And I realize we're talking of rookies or those with only 1 year of experience, but looking in the points, like Kiffin Simpson is the closest driver within the Ganassi group, and he's 15th, which is actually super impressive. But Dixon's second in the standings, Alex is fourth. Erickson, again, in light of being nearly last at the opening race and then improving that to a fifth last weekend, he's up to 12th in the standings. But that's the other big thing. Kirkwood had a pretty decent weekend in Long Beach. Didn't have a great one in St. Pete. So if they can have a couple of races that are just good, they don't even have to be great for Marcus and for Kyle, I think we see them move forward for sure, nestle themselves nice and close to Colton. And then we're talking about an Andretti Global that, to your question, having dropped from four cars down to three, I would say is certainly a better version of itself. That's all we got for this episode, y'all. Appreciate everything you sent in. Greatly appreciate our friend Jerry Siddeth. Be putting together, a show here next Monday when I get home, I think midnight or something like that from Barber Sunday night, if all travel plans go according to plan. But thanks, y'all. Appreciate y'all and all of our partners, Pfaff Technologies, the Justice Brothers, and TorontoMotorsports.com. I'll speak to y'all next week.